And that allowed us to go from an exam that was about 5.5 to 6 minutes to something that was roughly 2 minutes long.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the X-Health Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. We're in Lausanne, Switzerland, at the Biopol campus, hosting 120 life sciences companies covered in thick fog today. Professor Raphael Schnittmann is a co-founder of Perivision, a computer scientist and biomedical engineer that works closely with clinicians on AI solutions in ophthalmology. Perivision is a Swiss startup, a spin-off from the University of Bern. Their eye test headset uses virtual reality, cloud computing, and AI to test for glaucoma and visual field. It reduces the test time up to 70%. You'll hear why many people don't even know they have glaucoma, how glaucoma is diagnosed now, why it is so frustrating, and how to move the whole process home to the patients. Raphael, so 3 days ago, you got this news that you might be able to help pretty soon. Like, how many people in the world?
So, the target is, we're talking about around 80 to 100 million people who suffer from glaucoma. And indeed, yeah, we got the good news just a few days ago that, we'll be selling in the US, our system. We're really excited about that potential. And, finally, you know, seeing the fruits of the labor of the work that was involved into bringing something that came from a very early idea into what is now a commercial entity with a product.
Okay, so let's maybe just start with, like, what is glaucoma, right? Because it leads to blindness, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. So glaucoma is one of those chronic eye conditions. So once you have it for life, and there's no cure. And what happens is that it's a disease that attacks the optic nerve. So the material that connects your eye to your brain and sends all that sensory information. And the cause of the disease itself is not really known. So the genesis of the disease is not known. And what happens in practice is that the way we manage the disease is really what happens on a clinical level. So how do you treat and manage glaucoma to ensure that the progression isn't aggressive, or that we try to slow down that progression? So in a sense, it's kind of a lose-lose for the patient. And we really, from a healthcare point of view, we're really just trying to manage that disease.
Okay. And could you go into more details about the eye anatomy and how it starts to dysfunction, please?
Sure. So the eye is basically an oversized ping pong ball with the pupil that allows light to enter. That's what allows us to see. And the light hits the back of the eye, called the retina. And this is where you have photoreceptors that pick up the light. And this light, these photoreceptors, they carry the information through nerves. And these nerves come together at what's called the optic nerve. And that's at one location in the eye. And this optic nerve then goes all the way to the brain. And that's how we have connection to the brain. And in the case of glaucoma, it's often associated with some eye pressure that's built up inside the eye, which causes tension, basically, and presses down and affects these connections. And so a lot of glaucoma is linked to eye pressure, not always, but often linked to eye pressure. A consequence of that is that a lot of the treatment approaches is about relieving eye pressure, either through drops or through surgery.
So guys, just to note here, we're not medical doctors, neither me nor Professor Schnittmann. So please do not consider anything we say here as medical advice, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how is glaucoma diagnosed nowadays?
Yeah. So diagnosis is typically diagnosed with a multitude of instruments. So there's no one single instrument that says you have glaucoma. It's a mixture of things. Because the disease typically is a perceptual disease, so it's a slow-moving disease that patients start to realize, hold on a second, I'm walking into chairs. I'm not seeing things on the sides because glaucoma typically reduces your field of view from the outside in. So initially you don't notice it until you start banging more often into objects or people, or you can't see a whole side on the right side or the left side. And so.
So you get used to it basically, right? Like it's narrows, like the vision narrows.
Exactly. The vision narrows. It's called, actually the nickname for the disease is the silent thief of vision. So it steals the vision quietly, which is scary. And so the way that it's diagnosed is a mixture of using pressure measurements of the eye, also some imaging of the eye to see what's happening on the retina, specifically on the optic nerve area, and using an instrument called a perimeter, which is basically an extension to what's called visual acuity. So everyone who has glasses and those who done driving exams, we've all done vision exams, but you know, there's these charts where you read the letters at a set distance, and depending on the size of the letters, you calibrate your glasses. Perimetry is just an extension of that. That doesn't just focus on the central field of view, so where you really can read well, but everything outside of that, so the on the outside. And that's exactly where glaucoma typically affects vision. So we do what's typically called a perimetry exam to measure what's called the visual field, how well you see light, not just in the center of your field of view, but outside of it.
Okay, what does this perimeter look like?
You can think of it as a pretty large machine that can sit on a table. It's roughly maybe 50 by 50 by 80 centimeters big, so it's a big cube, and it has characteristic big bowl. Like, think of it as a giant bowl, and you put your head in this bowl and you set your chin on a stand, and you just fixate a target at the back of this bowl. And what happens is that inside this bowl, the machine shines light of different intensities while you're focusing at one location. And every time you see the light, you click a button. And after about 8 minutes, or depending on the exam type, 5 to 8 minutes, we have a map of how well you can see light all around you. And you do this per eye, typically. So that's traditional 101 perimetry, yeah.
Right, so there are these different, well, diagnostic approaches, right? And then there is this diagnosis, and what can be done?
Yeah.
Because it's not curable, is it?
Exactly. So once the diagnosis is set by looking at perimetry imaging and pressure typically, what happens then is that depending on the severity of the stage of the disease, then there's a treatment recommendation of what's going to happen. And so depending on where you are in the world and your ophthalmologist or your healthcare provider, there are different ways glaucoma is managed. But there's typically three types of treatment options. One of them is eye drops that you take home and you apply them yourself. Then there's a slightly more invasive approach using laser therapy. And the last one is surgery. And all three of these are effectively trying to manage eye pressure. And depending on the severity, you'll opt for one kind of approach before the other. And that's really the treating ophthalmologist that will dictate what's the best approach for that specific patient.
So it's not that you actually treat the nerve, you do treat the eye, the eyeballs.
Yeah, so what you're really trying to do is relieve this pressure to remove the pressure off the optic nerve. So that's the long and the short of it, actually.
Okay, and so does it work well? Or I wouldn't be here probably if it worked well, right?
Yeah.
We wouldn't be speaking.
So it's important to know that glaucoma can onset at about age 50. So relatively young, at least from a working, a decent part of the glaucoma population are in working age. And so does it work well? Yes and no. You have the issue with glaucoma is that part of it will be stable for long periods of time, or relatively stable, and then will drop And you have other patients that drop continuously, but very slowly in there. So the reality is you have different kinds of patient profiles. And these therapeutic approaches, yes, they can be very effective for given parts of time, but it's still something that you have to monitor every year. So typically patients will go to their treating healthcare practitioner twice a year. Every 6 months, they'll go for a routine checkup of what's happening with the disease.
A question here. What is the stage when you start actually banging on furniture? Or like you don't see it? Like, is there any earlier stage that you can notice there's something going wrong?
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The Exhale Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't, please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode.
That's a hard question. So most people who will find out that they have a glaucoma at a very early stage do so at a stage where diagnosing glaucoma is actually very tricky. So typically when people realize that they're banging into things, they're already at a, they call it early glaucoma stage, but effectively there's already damage that's happened. Yes.
And so is there any way they could see it before? You
know? As far as I know, not in routine clinic. But I'm sure people are working on this from a research point of view. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just thinking whether to ask you now about what do you offer? Because you do offer a diagnostic solution, a different diagnostic solution. But maybe before we jump into this, we could speak about like how did you really invent it, or like, you know, where did the idea come from?
So for us, the story started in 2015 when I hired Sharifa Couture, who's actually the CTO now today of Paravision. I hired her as a PhD student to work on a project, which was to investigate using machine learning techniques and AI to investigate the relation between the structure of the retina and the function, so the visual field, how well we perceive. There's always this relation in ophthalmology between structure and function.
What was there any goal of this research, or was it like a basic research?
It was a pretty basic research question at the time. It was to understand if imaging could help in giving better indications on visual function. So it was a basic question, and we started together working on it. And we were just getting nowhere. We were absolutely getting nowhere.
How long? For how long?
I think we were swimming in a nowhere ocean for a good 6 to 9 months. And at that point, you know, we went back to the clinicians and said, look, let's try to understand a little bit more on these visual fields, because we're looking at this data and we just don't get it. We don't get it. There seems to be a huge amount of noise. What is happening? And so we started really spending time in the clinic, looking at how these exams were done, how the study nurses were doing them, how the assistants were doing them, what was happening with the patients. And then it became super apparent that perimetry as an examination, just no one liked it. It was just one of those things that the patient didn't like it. It's long. They get tired. You're moderately comfortable sitting with your head on inside this bowl. So they're not happy. And because it's a functional exam, a lot of the way the quality of the results you get depends on the psychology of the patient in that moment.
Oh, what does it mean? Like how patient they are.
Yeah.
Basically.
So because it's like an exam where you see a light and you click a button, if your patient is anxious, your results will get skewed. And so a lot of patient collaboration in the exam is really important for good quality data. And then on the other side, the clinicians and the assistants, are forced to basically look at a screen to make sure the patient is always fixating one location. So that's intensive for them. And the physicians, they look at this data and they know that a lot of the data is very noisy. So it's hard for them to make diagnostics information.
What is it? What's the noise?
The noise is really because when you shine this light, you have to be sure that the patient is looking at the right thing, at the right location in the field of view. And also, you know, having a coffee potentially changes your state and you can see impacts. In fact, there are studies that have shown the effects of coffee on visual field measurements. Oh. So it's just something that the clinical community has gotten used to, that visual field examinations are noisy and you have to interpret them with a decent amount of experience, or with a grain of salt, depending on how you look at it. So we saw this and we said, from a data science point of view, this is both a disaster and a goldmine at the same time. So it was really fascinating to see. And then with Sharifa, we said, okay, let's take this opportunity and look just at visual fields to understand things a little bit better. And the first thing we focused on actually was what we saw from the patients is that these exams were way too long. So it's, you know, you're putting your head in a bowl and that's the only thing you're supposed to see. And if you want to try this at home, take a spoon and put it on your eye, a large spoon, and put it on your eye and just look at it. And you'll see that after a few minutes, you first of all get disoriented. And then over time, it just gets tiring being in that environment. And if you do that for a few minutes, you sense it. And typically patients are not young patients. They're not healthy patients. They're either they have glaucoma, they might have other diseases at the same time, they have other comorbidities. So we said, okay, we got to somehow find a way to have a really fast exam, to do this really quickly.
So I can also imagine that, you know, the line of like when the patient is focused is actually dropping, right?
Exactly.
With time.
Yeah. So the first minute, you know, they're in it, they still have energy to do it. And then there's just a tail off. And the longer the exam goes, that tail off gets worse and worse and worse.
So why do you keep going with these exams, you know, for that long?
So, and that's because what you're doing in this examination is you're shining this light at different locations. And these locations correspond to locations on the visual, on the retina.
So you need to test it on different...
at different locations, and you want to get a dense image, a dense grid of all the regions that see well. And that is the fundamental problem of why it's slow. And so what we did with Sharifa is come up with a method that allowed us to only select a few locations to examine and predict what the other neighboring locations were without ever looking at them. And that allowed us to go from an exam that was about 5.5 to 6 minutes to something that was roughly 2 minutes long.
Okay, let's just stop here for a moment. And I want to ask you about, like, was there any, when you were speaking with clinicians, was there any like an aha moment or like one clinician that you spoke to and he or she was, you know, explaining something, or a patient that you saw, like, is there an image like that or any, yeah.
So definitely being in a clinic. So we were fortunate enough in the lab to be across the street from the eye hospital. So it's really about walking over and talking to people. And so after, you know, seeing, you know, 30, 40 patients doing this exam, you get a sense of the frustration that's happening, especially this is not their first time they're doing it. They come back and do it every 6 months. And then from the clinical side, yeah, we had great partners with whom we worked, from the assistants to the physicians. And the aha moment maybe came when we had put together the realization of how many locations really need to be tested to get a good sense of what the visual field was and whether or not every single location was critical for a clinical decision to happen from that.
Could you give a number here?
So in practice, what we've seen is, so the typical exam is about 60 locations that are imaged. And in practice, we can bring it down to about 16 to 24 locations.
How did you select them?
Yeah, so that's actually the core of what Sharifa did during her PhD, is from a data science point of view and numbers crunching perspective, come up with an algorithm that automatically selected what locations to test for a given patient. That work was then published, patented, and then subsequently validated in a clinical trial at the hospital on real patients. And we showed the efficacy of that kind of approach from a time quality point of view. So despite being much faster, you can maintain the same kind of noise level as those 5 to 6 minute long exams. So there's no point doing those anymore. They're just longer. So we were very excited about that. And at that point with Sharifa, we said, okay, well, now that we have a better way of capturing data and a better understanding of those visual fields, let's go back to just trying to understand glaucoma a bit more. And so she worked on predicting or automatically identifying glaucoma subjects from visual fields. And we worked on that, always in mind of, we'll get back to that structure function problem that we had set out for. But it was roughly maybe 6 months after the completion of our clinical study, we realized that actually this bowl, this giant bowl that people are using, was completely stupid. It was just a archaic technology from a hardware point of view.
How old is this?
So the concept itself is from the 70s. And a lot of these machines, if you open them up, it's literally a box that looks like it's from 1990. So, of course, it lent itself to say, we should be able to do more. And at the same time, what became super apparent is that if we ever really wanted to reduce the amount of noise we had in visual fields, which is one of the killers for the clinicians, we were going to have to image patients more often. And the only way to do that is not to bring them in the clinic. And that's to allow patients to do it anywhere, and in particular at home, especially if your exam is 30 seconds or 2 minutes long. Because then you can compare it to brushing your teeth in the morning. You know, maybe every week you do an exam, who knows, maybe even at home. And that's when the idea started coming about that, oh, maybe we should look into how you can do home monitoring instead of having patients come over and to the clinic. And of course, that all came together at a time where virtual reality headsets were becoming very popular. Many companies out there were building virtual reality headsets. And so we started exploring that potential of, could you use a smartphone? Could you use a VR headset to combine with these fast testing strategies? And that's effectively how PeriVision, the first version of PeriVision, came about. Say, okay, we saw an opportunity to bring better perimetry to patients at home so that they could be monitored in an effective way. And yeah, that was the genesis of the company, in effect.
It sounds like you basically started with glaucoma in mind, or like, why glaucoma is the first disease?
So we had been working in that space. We saw an opportunity in terms of monitoring those patients. It lent itself for it. And the volume of patients was very important, of course. So, you know, we're talking about, as I mentioned earlier, 80 to 100 million people. This is important. And on top of that, many of them don't even know that they have glaucoma. Right. So it's a space where it felt like there was a lot of opportunities to provide better patient quality of care. It made sense. At least to us, it made sense to focus on that. Of course, when you combine AI and these virtual headsets to do eye exams, you know, you can do lots of things. Right, lots of opportunities show up. And these devices are capable of doing more than one exam. But that's a segment that made a lot of sense to start off with.
How does it work then?
So the technology in itself is straightforward, in the sense we're talking, the PeriVision system today is a virtual reality headset that you can wear with a clicker. There's a web platform that connects the VR headset to basically an interface for the clinical staff. And the clinical staff can basically assign examinations that are then given to the patient to perform, whether it's in their clinic, in the doctor's office, or potentially at home. And then from that, do an examination that's quite fast and transmit that information through a web server, basically a cloud, back to the platform so that the data can be viewed by the healthcare practitioners.
So let's maybe speak about the tech that's a bit deeper, like part by part,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
So we start with the VR headset. What's in there? So that's the hardware, right?
Yeah, so from a hardware point of view, we're not using anything particularly fancy or complicated. I think the one important thing that we're using in the VR headset that is important to Paravision is there's two components. One of them is that our system is not tethered, meaning there's no cable that runs from the headset to a computer somewhere. So to really give full flexibility to the person using it.
Can it be like any headset?
So today, headsets, some of them have this cable that goes and connects to somewhere, and some of them don't. We've focused our work on one that allows you full mobility. And the other component of this technology, of the VR technology that's important to us, is that there is integrated eye tracking. So this allows us to monitor in real time where the eye is looking in the general field of view. And of course, that's important for perimetry so that you can really figure out what locations are being stimulated. And that's something that traditional perimeters don't have, or they have, but they're not typically used because they don't function very well.
Okay, what are the differences?
So the difference is that when you look at most systems that offer perimetry, eye tracking forces you're physically moving, or the eye tracking is going to move basically the head of the patient.
Oh.
And that is done mechanically, and that's slow. So in general, when you look at eye tracking in existing systems, most clinicians or tech assistants are switching off that option. It's just not really used. But in VR headsets, you don't even see it. You don't feel it as a user when you put it on. It's just happening passively. And that was really interesting from a technology point of view to leverage in this kind of product. So on the hardware itself, there's nothing particularly new or anything innovative that we are bringing to the table for the patient. This has now become off-the-shelf components that exist and that are really, really high performance. That's from the hardware point of view. The other key part is what's happening on the perimetry exams and the AI part. So here, this is really the core of what the company now is doing, is developing algorithms that are faster and less noisy in order to do strong perimetry examinations. So it's a lot of data crunching, a lot of machine learning approaches in order to both reduce noise, but also to predict what are the right locations that should be examined in order to have good visual fields at the end of the day.
Could you tell a bit more about this eye tracking part? Like how well the machine can see or see more than an ophthalmologist would see?
So the eye tracking in VR headsets, it's using typically infrared light to figure out where the pupil is using different cameras and sensors. And from that, figures out what is the exact position of the eye and where is it looking. It's not doing anything more than that typically, but it's enough for us then to take that information and to correlate it at the right time. If we shine a light there, where is the patient looking exactly? So we can figure out from the perimetry point of view then, okay, that light that we just showed and the patient looked here, that implies that we had a measurement at this location on the retina. That's at least how we're using it.
Doesn't matter if the patient, during the exam, moves her or his head.
So the head, no. If they move the eye while the exact light is shined, then typically that's a problem. But then we can see that and basically obfuscate that result. So it's Yes, of course, people move their eyes all the time. So it's something that we have to deal with as a constant.
Okay, and now this AI part or machine learning, or is it both? Or
what a good question.
It allows to do?
So this is a nomenclature issue. So typically machine learning is considered a part of AI broadly. In our case, we're really talking about machine learning. So predictive models that can infer what is the visual field? What is the true nature of the visual field given the data, given the history of the patient, and so on? Yeah.
So how did you train the model?
Yeah, so as with most machine learning models, it's trained on patient data that is performed through clinical studies and trials that allow us to get information. And we use that data to train a prediction model as to what is the state of a visual field.
In your case, was it like historical data? So were you using already existing data or were you, yeah?
Yeah, good question. So we use a mix of data, actually. Mix of data from historical data, but also from data from our specific device, so that you get, in a sense, the best of both worlds.
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode. Okay, and could you tell a bit more about like any clinical trials that you took part in?
Yeah, so we ran at the Bern University Hospital. We ran our, back in 2019, if I remember correctly. We ran a study with a decent number of patients using a VR headset to collect data from an examination with the headset, compare it against the standard, you know, machine that sits on a table in order to infer how accurate it was. And at the end of the day, we were very happy with the overall performance that we saw from our overall system. And maybe more importantly than that, we had given questionnaires to patients to understand a little bit how they felt from the entire experience. You have to keep in mind these patients, again, they're of a certain age. So not all of them are 50, which is still young, of course, but some of them are somewhat older. And it was very interesting to see that the level of acceptance that patients seem to have for a system that is, in many ways, new to them, very, very new, even more than the cell phone. So from comfort level to overall acceptability, we saw lots of positive signs of how a system like that might work out in practice in a clinic. So that was, in a way, almost more valuable to us than the raw numbers we got from the study. Yeah.
So you were mentioning before, like when you were observing people taking this exam on a perimeter, did you see, what did you observe, you know, with the headset on? Like, were people skeptical maybe about that, you know?
Absolutely. So in typically, what we saw, at least, that there were two kinds of patients. Those who were, from the onset, quite excited to try. So that was quite refreshing to see. And then those who initially weren't sure, with a certain level of apprehension, but still willing to do it. So of course, people are free to say, no, I'm not participating. And from the ones that had some level of reticence initially, they still came about understanding, oh, this is quite comfortable. This is, even though it's a thing you put on your head, it's quite light.
Oh, the heaviness they might have been worried about.
Yeah, exactly. It's a, this is potentially putting a headset on an 80-year-old person, you know, that maybe has other ailments. So that human factor part of the entire experiment was really important for us to understand, because given that perimetry and visual field acquisitions is basically a functional exam where you need the patient to be comfortable to get good results, it was clear to us that the whole experience needs to be one that is not a burden. And that is, I think, one of the key drivers of not only creating technology that is useful for the clinical team and staff, so the doctor and the technicians, but also a technology that patients like. And that came from that initial statement we had that, you know, perimetry, the most hated exam in ophthalmology by everyone. So that was very important to us, and that remains so to this day.
So I can imagine, like, again, you know, staying with the patients, you know, I can imagine that the question that can be asked, like, you know, oh, are we going into gaming now? You know, with A, one, excitement, B, is it gaming? I want it to be serious, you know, it's about my illness.
So as far as I know, gaming in perimetry, there are some cases where that's actually what you want to do, particularly in pediatrics for children, which is a different segment to us. So glaucoma doesn't actually happen in children in rare cases. But for the moment, we've stayed really in a sense of treating the entire experience as one that should be comfortable, that should be fit for the person using the device. We have an integrated digital assistant that kind of walks you through what's going to happen to do the exam, that that connects with the user. And we think that those things are very important for the entire experience.
So is there anyone, any, like you were mentioning, an assistant or a technician needed during the exam?
So traditionally, yes. And with our system, we believe that you won't need an assistant to do this. You need someone to set up the system, of course. But once the device is in the hands of the patient, you won't need this constant monitoring between the assistant or the technician and the patient to make sure that they're complying with the examination.
Yeah, so it's like, please move your chin a bit closer to me, or like,
yeah,
a bit
or please
to the
focus
right.
On your on the cross. Typically, it's a cross that we shine in the headset, and so it's really saying, oh, you know, and giving either encouragement or recalibrating the patient to refocus. So engaging the patient that way, we've seen, is already very, very interesting and appropriate, and others have shown similar things too.
Okay, and the numbers you mentioned. The numbers weren't that interested as patients, so we started with patients, but what the numbers said, the results of this trial?
So in the end, the result of the trial showed that by and large, there's a very strong correlation between standard perimetry that you typically have today in clinic and what this headset is providing. That was, in a way, the final, let's say, results we wanted before we really pushed forward with a company. And that's when things really took off.
What did the ophthalmologists say?
They were generally very excited. So that's one of the great things, having been in ophthalmology now and tech for almost 15 years. Ophthalmology is very special, I find, because it's one of those medical areas or disciplines where you pretty much always have a machine between the patient and the physician, because that's just the nature of ophthalmology. You always have an instrument looking inside the eye. And that's not always the case in medicine. You know, dermatology, for instance, is not like that. And I think what that does is that it created, or it made that ophthalmology as a medical discipline, that whole community is super interested in tech. They're very, very open to new technology, devices, data, and so on. And again, that's not always the case in medicine. And so VR, I think, is a place where we'll play a role in ophthalmology. AI and image analysis is absolutely taking a very important role in that space. And so in general, when we came with this concept forward to our clinicians, they were very excited. Of course, it's a huge potential to streamline processes within busy clinics, but also the opportunity to monitor patients at home is one that is very interesting clinically.
But you also started at the university hospital also. I mean, you have some special ophthalmologists there,
of
right?
Of course, yeah.
So I wanted to ask, like, do you think of any challenges really in implementing that? Like, what could they be?
Oh, there'll be a million challenges. that we know that we see that. They go from basic logistics to convincing people that your device is better than others, of course. To, I already have a machine, I've been with this company for X number of years, why would I switch over? Yeah, of course, switching device manufacturers is it can be scary. But at the same time, I think with the system that we're coming forward here, it's actually opening up an entire opportunity that current systems just don't offer. You can't take a perimeter home. Right. You just don't do that.
But why would you, on the other hand, like, what patients want and how would you send the device? Like, not everyone has, a headset yet.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first way to look at it is to say, I'm a glaucoma patient. I go see my physician and then maybe my physician suspects that things in the next year are going to look a little bit wobbly for my glaucoma. There's maybe a bit of a trend. So let's monitor that patient. And so what would happen at that point is that the physician would give a headset to the patient to take home. So they don't need to buy their own. That the idea would come from here, the physician is basically providing the headset and would bring it back at their next 6-month visit.
Okay, so it's kind of a rental or something.
Exactly.
Or under the insurance.
Correct. So in that case, at that point, what the physician gets access to is two things. A patient that has a device at home that potentially gets notified when things are changing abruptly, but they also get a much more granular opportunity. So an opportunity for more granular measurements. So potentially every week or every month, as opposed to these two endpoints of I saw this person 6 months ago and now again. And given that it's all very noisy, it's hard to make ends meet to really figure out what's happening. So for the treating physician, it's really an option that they'd never had before to just get a better look at what's actually happening for the patient.
So like sending reminders, for example, right? Please.
So that would be part of the story. Please do more, do an examination tomorrow morning, etc. So that's part of it, and that data then potentially gets sent to the physician. And if things really are looking bad at that point, the physician can intervene earlier, right? Instead of saying, oh, well, you're set to come to us in 6 months. Why don't you come in 2 months? Because things are looking a little wobbly. And that's actually a big problem in the United Kingdom, where what happens is that because the healthcare system is relatively strained, if you miss your appointment, you can go really long periods of time without seeing your treating physician. And in that time, you could, partially go blind. So having that option to monitor your patients, remotely presents a really an interesting opportunity.
Right. So we're focusing here on glaucoma, but is it the only disease that you're going to treat with that device? Or does it open up other possibilities?
I think given that the device is so compact and readily available and basically has a lot of tech within it, you can start doing lots of different examinations from typical visual acuity, so reading chart numbers, to seeing contrast or seeing color. You have lots of very standard exams in ophthalmology that you could do with that. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, can you go to other large diseases and large groups? So historically, doing examinations on the other big eye diseases like age macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy, those haven't interacted so much with the use of perimetry isn't so important there. But it might become more relevant given that there's a more and more interest in measuring visual function in patients. But this is something we'll have to see. Yeah.
And could you now, so because, I mean, you are not focused only on Perivision and only on this startup. So you have some broader view of like what's happening in ophthalmology and what's there. Like, how do you think this field of eye disease diagnostics may develop, or what are the interesting parts now that are developing fast?
So in ophthalmology, you have the, let's call them the big four eye diseases. So cataracts, glaucoma, AMD, and diabetic retinopathy. Those combine as over 600 to 700 million people. So it's a large chunk of people. And if you look at that spectrum, tech in ophthalmology is rapidly changing. So there is constant development. A lot of it has to do with the fact that ophthalmology is tied to imaging, to see inside the eye. And because it's tied to imaging, we're seeing an influx of technology related to image analysis. So they're dealing with images, handling images, processing images, automating identification of biomarkers to structural parts of the eye, and compressing that information to give it in a compact and meaningful way to treating physicians.
How did that develop? Like, how did you, or maybe when did you see the acceleration, and when did you join that? You know, because this is also interesting, right?
So I was fortunate enough to, so I started in ophthalmology in the area of retina surgery with robotics. At the time, it was the future. And it was a project that was light years ahead of its time in many ways. And it opened the door to understanding a lot about surgery in that space, constraints that are involved. And I was very interested at that time already in machine learning and understanding how imaging and machine learning play together and what you could do with it. This is circa 2010. And this is what's called the pre-deep learning wave, which is what we're currently learning, what we're currently in now. So there was a lot of interest in building computer vision methods that look at images, analyze their content, and finds things in them. And of course, that had a big role in diagnostics also. So can you identify diseases or biomarkers in images? And in about 2014, I started being more and more interested in, let's say, standard diagnostics in ophthalmology. And actually, things really started accelerating in about 2017, 2018, because deep learning had really installed itself. It became available in a much broader sense. And now it's just exploded.
How did you realize, like, oh my God, that's the fast train. Let's change the train. Or like, yeah, let's get on it.
So it became relatively clear towards, around 2014, 2015, that there was going to be a shift. It wasn't clear to what extent that shift was going to be. I think that surprised everyone a little bit. So it's also a lot about being at the right place at the right time. There's no fortune telling here. Huh? It's not like I had a crystal ball. But by the end of the 2010s, by 2018, 2019, things already looked on a set course, where we saw more and more papers, research that was tech, so machine learning, data-driven imaging, appearing in clinical conferences. So, and physicians were more and more interested in bringing people like myself into those communities to say, what is happening? What can we do?
Oh, wow.
So the pull came from them in many ways. And that was really very exciting to see. It's not the only time in radiology that was also happening. Mm. But in ophthalmology, it was very strong already in 2017, 2018 coming about. And again, I chalk it up to the fact that ophthalmologists really like tech. They really want the best tech possible to treat their patients. And that was, those things came together at that point in time. And now what's really nice to see is that you're having more and more commercial products that are entering that space and bringing, let's hope, value to both the clinical staff, the ecosystem, and the patient.
Right. So when can they, the ophthalmologists, get your tech now? So you, 3 days ago, we just started with that, right? 3 days ago, you got this FDA approval. Yeah, who can get it and where and when?
So you can order systems today in the United States. So use is cleared for the United States at the moment. And the hope is that by the end of this year or beginning of 2025, we'll have it in the European Union. And so availability, it's coming. Yes.
We're not speaking Switzerland, are we?
Switzerland will be part of the European Union approval process.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So it's there. Awesome. What are the next steps for PeriVision?
I think in many ways, the next step is to continue to focus on building exciting and meaningful technology to help physicians in the space of visual function. So to really provide the best possible visual function measurement system. So this is something that has often been neglected over the past three decades. This has to do with the fact that structural images, so what's called optical coherence tomography or color photo funduses, these are those typical images that you see the retina in red or orange colors. Those have been really important diagnostics tools for the last 20 years. And visual function has kind of been put on the side because it was noisy and people don't like doing it. But I think that's an opportunity. And in that sense, I think the company is in a good spot to keep building in that space and keep showing the value that can bring to measuring quality of patient care.
What do you need to make it happen, to still develop and, you know, to basically deliver it to, well, all these ophthalmologists, you know, both in the US and in Europe?
So we need good partners. Today, when you build a new technology, you need good teams, you need good people to work with. So that's something that we're currently building and will continue to build.
You mean like corporate partners or clinical partners?
Both. I think really you have to team up with people who help you along this path. It's very difficult in the medtech sector to do everything on your own. If you want to scale properly and reach the patient at the end, you really need to have a whole team concept about how you get there. And so that's part of, I think that's very important moving forward.
Rafael, so I think thank you very much for this conversation and like letting us into this, you know, the visual function measurement world, you know, and the ophthalmology tech of, well, actually today and a bit about the future. And you guys, if you want to learn more about PeriVision, please go to perivision.com. Thanks very much.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the Exhale Show. Leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.